I regard myself as a soldier, though a soldier of peace.
I have a dream that one day
a soldier of peace,
this nation will rise up,
a soldier of peace,
live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream,
though a soldier of peace.
I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. Every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it.
Nonviolence Radio, covering the beat of nonviolence worldwide, from the Meta Center for Nonviolence in Petaluma, California.
Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Nonviolence Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook. Ramadan Kareem. Today's the first day of Ramadan, and on today's show, we'll be exploring how to support nonviolent movements, specifically in the Middle East. So, to start off the show with a bit of a question. The U.S. president has poured $110 billion worth of arms into Saudi Arabia in an effort to, quote, build security and to end terrorism. And as we know in nonviolence, that's only going to create more, especially when these arms and weapons will be used against civilian populations. So the big question of the day is, what would be the nonviolent equivalent of pouring $110 billion worth of nonviolence into the Middle East and discovering what it is? So this question we'll be exploring with Michael Beer, who is the executive director of Nonviolence International, but we'll also be hearing the voices of other activists and previous guests of Nonviolence Radio who have chimed in on this topic in the past. So nonviolence has been explored in the Middle East. Most people know about it in terms of, say, the Arab Spring. And what also is a bit of a challenge is understanding how a situation like Syria has become what it is and how nonviolence can then respond to a situation of such complex violence taking place there. And what we know as nonviolence activists and as nonviolence educators is that there has been nonviolent movement in Syria in particular that really was able to be shown when the veil was lifted, say, on the political scene in the Middle East through the Arab Spring. There was a budding nonviolent movement that felt that it wasn't quite prepared for what was about to take place. And I want to share with you a bit of an interview from a gentleman named Bashir Saeed, who we got to interview in 2012, and his statement about his belief in nonviolence and what was taking place in Syria at the time in 2012.
What happened in Syria in the last 1 year was a consequence or a chain reaction from what happened in other Arab nations. So we feel that we were in Syria totally unprepared for such huge and massive revolution. What happened in the first few weeks was some sort of civil resistance, civil movement, nonviolent protests. But we very soon everything changed, and starting from separated incidents of resistance and shooting at regime's forces, it turned out to be a huge campaign for supporting the Free Syrian Army. Of course, we have all the sorts of excuses, and that the regime is killing us and we are only self-defending ourselves. However, we know that civil resistance and nonviolent campaigns do not accept these excuses to relent to violence. We at all times say that nonviolent works better than any violent campaigns. I've read some books saying that there is no relationship between the brutality of a regime and the chances of nonviolence to work. I do not agree. I think once you adopt understandingly and mentally nonviolent ways of resistance, it means that the more the regime is brutal, the more nonviolent works. That's how I believe. And what's happening in Syria is that we are not ready. Some people were ready to give the nonviolent all the chances that it can give. But the problem is that we have apparently did not make enough efforts, or we're not prepared enough, and things are getting out of hand. We are not describing currently what's happening in Syria as being a civil war. It is not. It's still like two major parties, but we know all the problems that are usually associated with arms. Those who are paying for the arms, they have conditions, and those who are having their own agendas are relying on their parts, and the regime is using this armed resistance to kill in a more savage way. What's happening currently in Syria? I hope that we can understand the lesson as soon as possible. We know that in other incidents where civil wars happened, it took them a long time to decide to stop the civil war. In Lebanon, for example, it took them like 14 to 15 years. In other places, it took them like 9 years, 10 years. We know that an armed struggle against a government averagely takes like 9 years. So I hope by the use of the internet and the Facebook and these social networks, we can reduce that time and convince people that this should come back to nonviolent actions as soon as possible. We need to give them examples. We need to give them hope in nonviolence. We need to let them understand that it's said that in Syria now, they all say from the starting of the revolution that the wall of fear has collapsed and people are standing. And I really don't think that the wall of fear has collapsed. We are still afraid of the government. We're still afraid of being imprisoned. We're still afraid of being killed. Once we lose these three fears, that's when we can say the wall of fear has collapsed. Thank you.
So that was Bishr Saeed, who is a Syrian nonviolence activist associated with an organization called Freedom Days. And you can look up that organization and find out what they're doing now. But that was back in 2012 when we had the opportunity to talk to Saeed. And he's actually the nephew of a very famous Islamic scholar, Jawdat Saeed. So the relationship between his deep understanding of nonviolence is directly related to being a part of a larger movement since he was a child in Syria. So this is very interesting. And we see that as this conversation took place in 2012 and what's taken place in Syria since then, what could have been different had the nonviolent movement been better supported, and what can we learn? And for that, I'm going to bring on Michael Nagler, my co-host, as well as Michael Beer, Nonviolence International Executive Director. So come on in. Michael Nagler, what did you have to say about this?
Yeah, Jawdat Saeed is not only a well-known Islamic and Quranic scholar, he is probably, for my money, one of the most, pure, principled, and deeply ingrained exponents of pure nonviolence that I've had the pleasure of meeting in my lifetime. It was really quite something. Now, Bashir mentioned this figure of about 9 years for an armed insurrection to run its course, and he was referring probably to the work of Erica Chenoweth and Maria Stefan, and they showed that of a nonviolent one takes about 3 years. Now, the principle that he was referring to, that if a nonviolent insurrection is not thoroughly prepared on every level, emotionally, the wall of fear has to come down, but there has to be, as Bashir said, understanding. You have to know when to use which strategic principles. You cannot just sort of spring into action the way you can't spring into action in a military campaign. So we have seen this over and over again. I was personally quite involved in the campaigns in Kosovo in the 1990s. And you had a very well-developed, extremely courageous, civil-based, nonviolent resistance on the part of the Kosovar Albanians, which was making a lot of headway against the Serbian regime. They had gotten the use back of their university in Pristina. They had gotten permission to have instruction in the Albanian language. All these things were going well, but the international community was not paying any attention. And what got their attention was at one funeral, one representative of a guerrilla group, the KLM, showed up with his weapons, and immediately the West was involved, and that led to military intervention, bombing, and so forth. Incidentally, 11 weeks of NATO bombing had no effect. In fact, it did the exact opposite. It was once again what the CIA calls blowback, and actually strengthening the Milosevic regime in Belgrade. Mm-hmm. And when a nonviolent movement was launched into the year 10,000, it took exactly one day after the preparation. It took one day to dislodge him.
Thank you, Michael Nagler. I'd like to invite Michael Beer, who's the Executive Director of Nonviolence International. Michael, can you weigh in on this, the need for support of nonviolent movements in the Middle East, Syria as being one example, but there are many others which we'd hope to cover in the show today as well. Michael.
Well, I'm very touched by the speaker's words about Syria. It certainly is a conflict where a lot of people are suffering on a huge scale. And we are thinking about the Syrian people every day. Let's not forget them. We have 4 or 5 million, I think, in exile and many who are internally displaced. And there's been enormous numbers of people killed. There still is a nonviolent resistance movement in Syria. One of the most remarkable is in the city of Idlib, which has been controlled by Islamist rebels. And the civil society there, led by the Al-Idlibi House, which is a kind of a confederation of civic groups, has essentially forced the Islamists out substantially, and they have elected a council that runs democratically in Idlib. There are women's movements there. There are theater movements. There are strong efforts, particularly up in the northeast in the Kurdish Syriac areas, to promote religious tolerance between the Abrahamic faiths. And there's enormous amounts of humanitarian work going on throughout the country by doctors and by rescue workers. And so there's a huge amount of efforts going in to promoting and working for a peaceful and just Syria. They are, of course, all being done amidst a horrendous civil war in which there are enormous numbers of outside actors in the country. And it's unfortunately not up to the Syrians alone. It's impossible for them to, even with the best nonviolent campaigns or even violent campaigns, they would not be able to solve their problems fully, because there is such massive intervention from the neighbors, including Turkey and Saudi Arabia and Iraq and Jordan and Israel and Hezbollah in Lebanon and the United States and Russia and Iran. And then there are, of course, jihadi fighters from all over the world who have come to fight with the Islamic State.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's going to require a combination of a massive diplomatic effort where all of the countries and peoples come together, as well as Syrian internal work, to try to move the country to peace and some sort of stable future. And so there are wonderful examples of people doing work despite horrendous situation. And let's keep doing what we can to send money, to send all kinds of support. to these people in Syria, and also let's pressure the United States, for those of us who are American citizens, and pressure the other countries of the world to talk and sit down and work for peace in Syria, rather than seeing Syria as some sort of piece of meat to be carved up by various foreign national militaries.
That's Michael Beer. He's the executive director of Nonviolence International. And Michael, as you are describing a bit of all of the various factors at play in a situation such as Syria, because this is a bigger question, looking at supporting nonviolent movements in the Middle East, and Syria is probably one of the places to say, well, this is an impossible situation. But as somebody who is a student of nonviolence and passionate about nonviolence, when I hear of all the various factors, to me it says it's going to require a very creative solution, more creative than ever before. So it gives a huge opportunity for the nonviolence movement to get more creative than they have ever been before. Michael Nagler.
Michael, thank you very much for those comments. And I have a question for you. You may or may not know the answer to this, but I've been puzzling about it. This group in Idlib that has taken over, basically, and kept the Islamists at bay, so to speak, I wonder, to what extent would you say that they are using really nonviolent means and operating in a nonviolent spirit? Because I know that one of the things that they've taken over is, quote, security, unquote. And this is an issue for us because very often the fact that it's a civil resistance takes precedence over the fact that it's using violence or nonviolence. So do you know that, Michael? To what extent are they a nonviolent movement?
I don't know fully the answer to your question. I know that they've used a lot of nonviolent methods to engage the Islamists, militarists for 2 years, and so I do know they've been quite successful in using these nonviolent methods. Security, you know, is a challenge in an environment like that, where there are an enormous number of gun pollution. And so I don't know the answer to your question about how they're doing security and to what degree they may be using guns and weapons and violence in the security work that they're doing.
Thank you, Michael Beer. So this actually brings up another question for me in terms of the bigger picture of nonviolence in the Middle East and the bigger picture about nonviolence, which is it really has to break up our image and our stereotypes of not only who we are, but what religions and certain religions promise. So as a skeptic with looking at nonviolence, they would say, well, it's just our nature to be violent. So these wars and this violence is all a part of who we are. And coming at it from the nonviolent angle, we're trying to say, actually, there's a whole different story and there's a whole different history that has been happening in tandem with the violence. And that's a story in the history of nonviolence taking place. And we can go back in all of the various traditions and faiths and find that lineage, that nonviolence lineage, as we were saying, that Bashar Sayyid, a major nonviolent activist and Syrian, who was a part of it at the very beginning, is the nephew of Islamic scholar Jawdat Sayyid, who Michael Nagler says has the purest nonviolence of anybody he's ever met. So let's break up our stereotype even more for the listeners of understanding that there is a role for nonviolence in Islam. Today being the beginning of Ramadan as well, this is an important look, it's important for us to take a look at what is Islam, what effect does it, because it does play a role in the Middle East, and what role does the idea, for example, of jihad play. So this is Sambal Ali Karamali, who is the author of The Muslim Next Door, and she's going to be talking to us next about Islam, nonviolence, and jihad.
Most middle school kids now learn about these. You know, there are five pillars of Islam. So really, in order to be a Muslim, all you have to do is believe that there's only one God and that Muhammad is his messenger. And then the things that you're supposed to do, which are kind of the pillars of the religion, are you have to give to charity, fast, pray five times a day, make a journey to Mecca in what is now, you know, Saudi Arabia, once in your lifetime, if you can afford it. So those are the five pillars. There's the declaration of faith, fasting, prayer, donation to charity, and pilgrimage to Mecca once in your lifetime, if you can. So, you know, jihad, which is something that comes up all the time, especially in the context of you know, the terrorists. I mean, the BBC now uses jihadist as interchangeable with terrorist, and that is something that just breaks my heart, because jihad, for one thing, is not a pillar of Islam. It's not even a word that I ever heard of until I got to high school. And what it really means is struggle. So jihad means struggle. There are two kinds of struggle. There's the internal struggle to make yourself a better person, and there's the external struggle to make society a better place. And in the external struggle, the external jihad, you can make society a better place in a number of ways. You can have jihad by the word, which is using words to make society better, like that means writing to your congressperson or writing letters to the editor. There's jihad by the hand, which is doing good works in order to make society better, such as volunteering for a soup kitchen, for example. And then finally, there's jihad by the sword, which is defined as taking up arms in self-defense or to overthrow an oppressor. So jihad is very limited. It's not just war when you feel like making war. It's war in self-defense or to overthrow an oppressor. And even if there's a legitimate jihad, there are many rules of engagement. So even if you're in a legitimate jihad, you may not kill civilians. You may not kill people taking refuge in holy places. You may not kill clergy. You may not kill children. You can't poison the water supply. You can't commit terrorism, which is defined as the clandestine use of force. You can't arbitrarily destroy property. You can't poison the water supply or commit suicide. Really narrow. I mean, these are, I would argue, are even narrower than our modern international rules of warfare. So obviously, if you look at these rules, ISIS, there's no way those people are committing jihad. I mean, they're just criminals. They're killing civilians. They're committing so many violations of Islam and Islamic law that that they're criminals. They're not jihadists.
You said there's a jihad of patient forbearance, and that I know that patience is another word for nonviolence. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, absolutely. So while the early, so, you know, Islam was born in the 7th century in Arabia. And so while this kind of jihad doctrine was being developed, and again, there's the internal jihad to make yourself a better person, but while the military or taking up arms jihad was being developed by some Islamic scholars, other Islamic scholars were developing a jihad of patient forbearance. And they did this on the basis of two things. One is that there are more verses in the Quran about patient forbearance than there are about fighting. And the second thing is that they looked to the Prophet Muhammad's example. So when the Prophet Muhammad was, when he first started his prophethood, I guess you could call it, when he was 40, for 12 years, he never took up arms. He practiced nonviolent resistance against his persecutors, who were the powerful people in the city he lived in Mecca. So he and his followers were persecuted for 12 years, but they practiced nonviolent resistance by continuing to preach, both in secret and in public, by encouraging the followers to emigrate when things got too bad for them, and by buying slaves who had converted to Islam and setting them free. So that was how they practiced nonviolent resistance. And Muhammad also, he never started a war. All the fighting verses in the Quran have to do with an ongoing conflict with the Meccans. So the jihad of patient forbearance was developed based on these things, based on the Quran and based on the Prophet's example. And although, you know, we hear a lot about people committing violence in the name of Islam. There have been countless instances of people using the Quran as a basis for nonviolence. Mm-hmm. So in the 1940s, Abdul Ghaffar Khan, whom you mentioned, also called Badshah Khan, was a Pashtun living in the northwest part of Pakistan, what's now Pakistan, you know, near the sort of between the border of Pakistan and Afghanistan. And he was a Pashtun who are fierce warriors who were renowned for being very quick to offense and quick to, you know, use weapons and quick to continue blood feuds. And yet he got 100,000 of his fellow Pashtuns to put down their weapons and march against the British in nonviolent resistance. And, you know, the British regiments would fire on them and they would die, and more Pashtuns would come to take their place unarmed, and they never picked up arms. And Badshah Khan spread this idea of nonviolent resistance as a part of the Jihad of Patient Forbearance, as based on the Quran. But there have been also other recent examples as well. So nonviolent resistance in Pakistan was responsible for overthrowing Musharraf, who was the military dictator there until recently. Also in the Maldives, nonviolent resistance and peaceful protests were responsible for ousting their dictator, who had been ruling for 30 years. And obviously, you know, the Arab Spring started as nonviolent resistance against the dictatorships there. And in Tunisia and in Egypt, it stayed nonviolent. Tunisia is now a democracy, so it's really nice to see that that one was successful. But there have been, you know, countless examples, and I think those need to be brought out, because I think every religion has a peace tradition, and Islam is no exception. Again, there are more verses in the Quran on peace and patient forbearance, and even the verses that do have to do with fighting in the Quran are always followed by a verse that says something like, but do not attack them unless they attack you first, mm-hmm. or do not be the aggressor because God loves not the aggressors, mm. or, you know, or if they cease to fight, you must also cease to fight. So in the Quran, you know, those fighting verses are limited by these other verses that always follow.
So that was Sumbul Ali Karamali, the author of The Muslim Next Door, about the nonviolent tradition within Islam. And let's turn back to our guest, Michael Beer. Michael, how would you say that this idea of nonviolence is even gaining ground today in the Middle East, as you see in your work in Nonviolence International? Are you more associated with certain nonviolent movements in the Middle East than others, or is there some movement in particular you want listeners to know about today?
Wow, that's you asked three or four questions there. I think there is widespread increased knowledge about nonviolence in the Middle East and around the world, and this is in part due to modern communication technologies. And I would hesitate to say that there's a kind of a growing trend in terms of nonviolent action in the Middle East at the moment. I think people are, in broad speaking terms, are faced with very difficult insecurity and problems, economic problems and political problems and security problems that are not...
Which pose it?
They're creating barriers at the moment for people to move forward. Where there are interesting movements to watch, I would encourage people and to support. In the Western Sahara, you continue to see disciplined, nonviolent protest against the Moroccan occupation, particularly in Laayoune and some of the other cities in Western Sahara. And many of these protests and campaigns are being led by women.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's fair to say that we often think in terms of nonviolence, not just in terms of coming up against governments, but in terms of social movements, which is, I think, where nonviolence is particularly strong. We're seeing continued movement by women, the women movements around the Middle East and around the world, that are very powerful and making progress. And what are some recent examples of that? Recently, there have been renewed examples in Iran of women getting into soccer stadiums because they've been excluded from attending soccer games. And there's been some success on that front.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't. I'm going to stop you there for a second, Michael Beer, to invite Michael Nagler to talk about a way that nonviolence was used recently in Iraq based on a desire to learn and use materials to keep nonviolent discipline in place during a movement. Michael Nagler.
Yes. Hi, Michael. I hope you won't mind the interruption, but I have a book called Nonviolence Handbook, as you know, and as you know also, Michael, it has been translated into Arabic, and I sent it electronically to an Iraqi exile living in Florence, a man named Ismail Dawood. I didn't hear from him for quite a while, so I thought, oh, well, you know, it went nowhere, like so many of my projects. But then I finally heard back from Ismail, and he said, I'm sorry I didn't get in touch with you earlier. Things were moving so quickly. And it turns out that an enormous demonstration that took place in Baghdad in April, where the demonstrators actually went into the green zone and the security forces allowed them to go in. And he said that that was kept entirely nonviolent. The nonviolent discipline was just about complete. And the reason was that all the leaders of that movement had been reading my book.
Very good, Michael Nagler. So that shows that there's a wide variety of ways. So I know that Nonviolence International is also involved in helping to get translations of nonviolence literature into places throughout the world, including, I believe, the Middle East. Is that correct, Michael Beer?
That's right. We've helped translate all kinds of materials into Arabic in particular. And not just translate materials, we have lots of materials that are written in Arabic that need to be distributed widely. In terms of, and particularly nowadays, people are unfortunately are not reading many books anymore, so there's more emphasis on trying to get movies and video out. And there are just so many phenomenal documentaries that are showing successful nonviolent movements of resistance, particularly in the Middle East. In terms of some recent examples that can inspire people, in the last week, there's been a resistance camp in Palestine called Sumud Camp, and it's been an alliance effort between Jewish nonviolent activists and Palestinian nonviolent activists and internationals, and they've been trying to help a Palestinian village which was erased from existence and to try to bring it back into existence. And they've been attacked by the Israeli security forces, and their tents have been destroyed now twice over, but they refuse to be kicked out. And it's a terrific example. You can go to sumudcamp.org. And go on there, and you can donate to them to try to help sustain this joint campaign, which is inspiring in itself, just getting Jews and Israelis and Palestinians working together to try to promote nonviolent resistance to the occupation there. Another way that people can participate is to go on delegations to the Middle East, the international Interfaith Peace Builders sends delegations to Palestine and Israel regularly. My group, Nonviolence International, is sending a peace delegation to Iran in the last week of June and first week of July. And we're trying to stop the Trump administration from launching a war against Iran. and we're going to go over there and meet with Iranians and let them know that we don't want war, and we're going to try to engage some of their militarists, of which they have many, and let them know that we don't want war with them and that that would be a disaster for the region. And so there's so much to go on. I hope people are not overly dismayed about the horrific violence and terrorism that's going on many levels, because there are phenomenal efforts going on by civil society in every country.
You're listening to Nonviolence Radio, and we're discussing the power of nonviolence in the Middle East in particular. $110 billion worth of violence poured into Saudi Arabia to help build security, which is only going to destroy security even more for everybody. What does $110 billion worth of nonviolence practice look like in the area and within our own movements here in the West is in the topic of the day. We have on the show with us live is Michael Beer from Nonviolence International. And we are talking about ways of supporting nonviolent movements. And I want to bring in a friend of ours who was also recently in town, Ali Abu Awad, who is working on a movement in Israel-Palestine called Tayir. And it's a movement to build a nonviolence actual movement, not actions here or there, but to try to build something much more comprehensive that takes resistance seriously. And what he reinforces what we learned from Ali Karamali, which is that nonviolence is integral in Islam, in the tradition, and that he is part of, and that but he moves from a violent stance to a nonviolent stance in his life, and so it becomes a very human story, and this is something I'd love to share.
Well, my name is Ali Abu Awad. I'm a Palestinian nonviolence activist. And actually, I was born for a refugee family from 1948. And I was raised and grew in the West Bank near Hebron. And my mother was one of the leaders of PLO, Palestinian Liberation Organization, and she spent a few years in the Israeli prison. And when I was a child, I remember when she was arrested, I was 10 years old. And I saw her was beaten in front of my eyes. And that was enough to bring me to whatever you call it, violence, resistance. And then in 1990, after my participation in the first Palestinian uprising, the first Palestinian intifada, which has started in 1987, I was arrested with my mother. So finally, I spent 4 years in prison, and my mother spent 5 years in the Israeli prison. And actually, the first encounter with nonviolence was in prison. Because, first of all, I have to say that Palestinian political prisoners have succeeded to create some kind of a very, very organized system to lead and manage their daily life, with a high level values of humanity and morality. You could see professors, teachers, the best people of the nation were in prison. So that was my university. So after three years in prison, we wanted to meet. I mean, me and my mother wanted to visit each other, and Israel refused. So we decided to go for a hunger strike that continued for 17 days of starving and struggling. And after that, we succeed to meet. Then I start learning about nonviolence. And then I was released by Oslo Peace Initiative. And when the second intifada started, as the failure of that initiative for many reasons, I was badly wounded by a settler in the, near Hebron. And while I was having my medical treatment, my brother was very violently murdered by Israeli soldiers. Then, after 1 year of struggling between revenge and giving up and trying to live normally, but you know, you are not the same person, it's not the same life, So thinking about revenge even was there, but the issue was, if it's about revenge, then it's about justice. What should be this punishment that I have to create to deal with my pain and my loss? And if it's about justice, so justice for me is to have my brother back. That's justice. But he will never come back. Does that mean that there is no justice? Then I remember reading about Malcolm X in prison, where he said, justice is just us. And I realized that justice is this step when we decide to give up being the victim of the victimizers, and not to be in this prison of hatred and victimhood. And this happened actually also by meeting Israeli bereaved parents who have lost someone in the conflict, and my life has changed because I have never met an Israeli who cry, or you don't see the humanity of the other side. So I become a non-violence activist, and I did many things, and I'm still doing big things.
So that was Ali Abu Awad of the Tagir movement in Israel-Palestine. And I want to bring back Michael Beer, the director of Nonviolence International, to see if what your comments are on his statement, because our president here in the United States has made it seem as though Israel-Palestine were not part of the Middle East, and it is. So how do you see the role of the Israel-Palestinian conflict in helping to generate awareness about nonviolence in the Middle East in particular?
Yeah, the Palestine-Israeli conflict gets enormous amounts of attention, even in the Middle East. Mm-hmm. And does provide an opportunity to promote nonviolent strategies for the future. I think of the other occupations in the Middle East, for example, the Turkish occupation of Cyprus or the Moroccan occupation of the Western Sahara.
Mm.
And you don't get any, you know, there's hardly any attention paid to these occupations or the movements that are fighting, working, struggling there. But Palestinians, despite their horrific kind of experience, are getting more attention, and does provide an opportunity. And the Palestinians themselves, to give them credit, have been going beyond Palestine to Israel and beyond to try to promote nonviolence around the region. Nonviolence International was started by Dr. Mubarak Awad and Jonathan Kitab, who are Palestinians. And they wanted to promote nonviolence all around the world, not just in Palestine. And Sami Awad, who's director of the Holy Land Trust, has gone around the Middle East to do quite a lot of training around the Middle East. And Nayef Haslamoun in Al Khalil has gone around the Middle East to do training in nonviolence. And there are others as well in the Palestinian world who have really promoted nonviolence throughout the region.
Great. Well, thank you, Michael Beer. Because where do we get this information? And I sort of want to segue over to that. How do we in throughout the world learn about these nonviolent movements, other than going to the website for Nonviolence International and getting a hold of you, Michael Beer, and others or people within? And the challenge, I think, is that when we look at, for example, how Arab Spring was expressed in the mainstream media, everybody sort of clamoring to try to understand what was happening and drawing from a theorist here or a theorist there, but without really having the full picture. And then with the lack of understanding of nonviolence, I mean, imagine if during Arab Spring it was like, here's the nonviolence movement here, this is how we can support them, this is how we can make it, make this kind of work expand. Now, there is social media. And social media, then, for our friend Bashir Saeed in 2012, he was saying, I hope that social media is going to help us spread these ideas and get people active. And so social media is a huge place for us to learn about nonviolence movements. Now, I have a friend who wanted to say something about the work of social media, because She's Iraqi. She's living in the United States, and she works in the private sector, but she in terms of social media. But she also has a master's degree in nonproliferation and terrorism studies from Middlebury Institute and International Studies Department. So let's hear from Farah Mohsin about her thoughts on the role of social media and helping to promote and spread nonviolence in the Middle East.
Sadly, there is not much to say when it comes to the mainstream media and nonviolence resistance in the Middle East today. Over the past 6 years or so, social media has taken over a large portion of people's lives in the Middle East. We've seen young men and women employ social media as a tool to help overthrow regimes and become successful at it at times, while other times they have become citizen reporters documenting the daily struggles of life under dictatorship and or war. For the most part, what I have witnessed is two extremes of the utilization of social media in the Middle East. There's the daily reporting of life under various forms of injustice, whether be it war in Syria and Iraq, or imposing theocratic laws in Saudi Arabia and Iran, or reporting on police and military brutality, such as the cases of Turkey and Egypt. The other extreme, however, is the widespread of, for instance, prank videos or makeup tutorials or celebrity gossip. These activities may be as normal as any videos produced in countries in the West. They are reflecting some form of normal practice of life in the Middle East, as well as they are probably not entirely accurate because they only reflect a small portion of a larger image of the Middle East. So the problem with this type of the social media use is the shifting of focus from the real issues that are plaguing countries in the Middle East, such as civil war, poverty, oppression, etc. The shifting is from these issues to a more kind of a desire to share and post popular topics that are more attractive and more appealing to younger generations. This also have overshadowed efforts made by young people who are trying to create change that is more sustainable through documentation of various oppressive and or aggressive situations that they have come across or do come across on a daily basis. These efforts are remaining to be small and need a lot of work because they are running against the more glamorous, sexy topics that young Arabs today are drawn to. But I would like to applaud some of these efforts that have been somewhat populated on social media platforms, such as Facebook and Twitter. These efforts are made by activists in Saudi Arabia and Iran. So in Saudi Arabia, for instance, last year we saw women began taking videos of themselves driving, defying government's laws of prohibiting women from driving. While the laws have not changed, sadly, the issue did gain a widespread support and recognition on the global scale. And then on the other hand, in Iran, we see there are activists of both genders. They are aggressively campaigning against laws that force women to wear the hijab. And this has been a long time issue documented on social media, but it's been recently relaunched by the spreading of educational videos on Facebook and other platforms to basically populate awareness of the ridiculousness of this imposed law and why it should be eradicated. So these efforts are still young and early in their steps. They're also facing big challenges. They're running against various political, social, religious challenges. There's always a hope that this type of mobilization of youth to use social media as a tool to overcome their oppressive environments is really strong. And it's also very empowering and inspiring as well. And just as the case with the Arab Spring and how social media helped change regimes in Egypt and Tunisia from oppressive dictatorships to somewhat, not so much, sorry, the case for Egypt, but more with Tunisia, somewhat of a form of a democracy. There is hope that these small efforts can thrive as well and help overcome these social today norms that are imposed by governments such as Saudi Arabia and Iran and other countries as well, and be reversed into a more secular form of governance and practice of life in the Middle East. Social media is a double-edged sword, and it is dangerous if it's not used properly, but there is hope that there is a large population in the Middle East that is very well educated and understands the caveats and pros and cons of using social media, and how can social media be used not just as a tool to report on war, which is important, but also how to create change and how to make it seem easy and doable and possible and defy any form of oppression there is. Thank you very much.
You're on Nonviolence Radio, and that was Farah Mohsin, who was discussing the role of social media in helping us to better support and understand movements in the Middle East and the way that social media is being used as forms of activism in the Middle East as well. So this show has been about how do we pour our energy and time and resources and understanding into nonviolence in the Middle East, especially with 110 billion-dollar arms deal happening in Saudi Arabia. Michael Nagler, my co-host, has a few resources that he'd like to share before we go.
Thanks. Thought you'd never ask, Stephanie. Yes, I'd like to mention two books that are in front of me now as we speak. One is by Mohammed Abu Nimer, also in Washington, D.C., I believe at American University, who has written an excellent manual or handbook called Nonviolence and Peace Building in Islam, Theory and Practice. The other is a highly influential book that's been translated into Arabic and Farsi, which means that Pashtuns can read it. And it's by Eknath Ishwaran, and it's called Nonviolent Soldier of Islam. This is a story that explodes four myths about nonviolence, that it can only be used by a weak person against a weak person, that's two of them, that it cannot be used on a large scale, and that it has no role in Islam. So I would strongly recommend Nonviolent Soldier of Islam. And finally, I just want to say to all of our listeners, Ramadan Mubarak.
Thank you very much, Michael Nagler. And on our show, Nonviolence Radio, we usually have some news. So you can find that news at the Meta Center's website, metacenter.org. That's Meta Center with two T's.
Just wanted also to mention, speaking of Iran, that I just gave a webinar for at a women's university in Tehran. And that will be available on our website also, metacenter.org.
So thank you very much to all of our guests. And till the next time, everybody, take care of one another. This is Nonviolence Radio.
An indefinable, mysterious power that pervades everything. It transcends the senses, while everything around me is ever changing, ever dying. There is a living power that is changeless, that holds all together, that creates, dissolves, and recreates. सबको सम्मति दे भगवान ईश्वर अल्लाह तेरो नाम सबको सम्मति दे भगवान ईश्वर अल्लाह तेरो नाम When peace breaks out, nothing but silence From the mainstream media show We want to know about nonviolence Where do we go? Nonviolence radio Tell your friend, tell your foe.
Ooh, nonviolence.
Challenging
radio.
Silence.
Nonviolence.
Challenging
radio.
Silence.
Ooh, nonviolence radio.
Challenging silence.
This is Michael Nagler, and I'm giving you some news and commentary from the world of nonviolence for May 2017 episode of Nonviolence Radio. As usual, I'm going to be telling you about some resources. And then a few news items with our commentary on them and a few upcoming events. So as for resources, I think, first of all, I'll mention two books. There's one by Micah White called The End of Protest, A New Playbook for Revolution. He talks mostly about rural takeovers as one aspect of rebuilding the world. And I'm happy to see his title because I think it's important for most of us to recognize that
protest has run its course. If you're familiar with the escalation curve model that we've developed for the Meta Center for Nonviolence, we are in phase two, and protest belongs in phase one. And I'll direct you to metacenter.org to check that out. And another important book that's getting a lot of coverage is by the two brothers, Paul and Mark Engler, called This is an Uprising. And I'm going to have more to say about that in our next episode, because, in fact, I'm actually going to read it. But I'd like to mention again the Institute, International Center for Nonviolent Conflict, ICNC. They continue to put out such fabulous resources. They have now a segment called Resource Roundup, which is just terrific. They have almost 100 monographs that are free downloads. And I just read the one on the nonviolent uprisings in Tibet, which I'm going to say a little bit more about when we get to the news. I do have something of a disagreement with the way ICNC uses their vocabulary, but we'll talk about that later. Then Pace Bene, the Franciscan peace organization that is in charge of the Catholic Nonviolence Initiative, have three things going on this September. The first are September actions, and I'll be saying more about them. Then, as I've mentioned before, they have a nonviolence training hub. I keep referring to that because I think that both training and strategy are absolutely critical components of getting, quote, beyond protest. And then they have a project called Nonviolent Cities, where you can have your city declared nonviolence. It's kind of like compassionate cities. So there are a lot of resources out there, but I think those are the ones that I will mention for this episode. Now, as for the news, I'm going to start with something we haven't really talked much about, and that is science news. There are some remarkable breakthroughs in what Bruce Lipton calls the biology of belief. In other words, they are now able to show exactly what parts of our genetic makeup are affected by our worldview and our belief system, and how they affect our longevity, among other life indicators. Now, I don't want to go into the science right now, but I want to mention one thing about a Commonwealth Club talk that was given on this topic by two distinguished biologists. So they talk about what I was just talking about, how our attitudes and our belief system are directly coded into our chromosomes, and how they in turn determine things like longevity or some degree of it. But in the description of the talk, this is what the Commonwealth Club listed. They say, that is the scientists say, that to live healthier and younger, we need to understand how sleep, exercise, stress, and diet can affect our telomeres. Telomeres being those portions of the chromosome which register the effects. Now, my point is, and this is kind of in the tear your hair out department, my point is how our prevailing worldview prevents us from understanding breakthroughs that are happening in the world. Because these two scientists do not stress sleep, exercise, stress, and diet. They stress our worldview, our belief system, like I said. But in reviewing it, the describers of this project weren't able to see that. So I'll mention a couple of other examples of how our worldview is inhibiting us as we go along. But to turn to local news, and this is a follow-up from Standing Rock, there is now an organization called the Treaty Alliance Against Tar Sands Expansion. And that is a coalition of 121 First Nations and other Indigenous tribes, First Nations being Canadian designation, and other Indigenous tribes from across North America that are united against major projects of doing tar sands oil extraction. I'm going to, as usual, give you a quote that kind of gives you a feeling for this project. Quote, "The Treaty Alliance is really about establishing an alternative discussion space and an alternative to the popular narrative." I really like that. And there's a quote from a man named Nepinak in a recent interview from Manitoba with Truth Out. He goes on to say, it's an alternative narrative looking at the need to transition to sustainable forms of alternative energy. Now, an Indigenous organizer named Matt Remley, based in Seattle, also told Truth Out that activists, quote, were not going to win a moral or environmental argument with the heads of corporations and banks,